Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco.
Where are we going today? What's on your mind?
The first thing that's on my mind is that it's May, and May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And so I want to kick off today's show with just a little friendly reminder that this is a great time to do a little self-check-in, kind of as we do with our physical health, making sure that we're eating well and getting a little exercise and that all of our aches and pains are noticed. It's the same with our mental health and well-being, that it's important to do those check-ins, to get a yearly checkup, whether it's going to see a therapist or doing your own kind of personal assessment. May is a great time to do it. Do a little self-assessment of your sleep habits. How are you eating? Are you moving a little bit every day? Are you connecting with others? Are you catching your breath? And allowing yourself time to just take a few calming inhalations and exhalations? Are you doing at least one thing every day that brings you joy? And are you able to actually feel joy or awe or happiness or love? Because at this point, you know, a bit over a year into the pandemic and kind of moving forward in some ways, it would be really normal in an abnormal situation to be struggling with some of these different aspects of our mental health and to be tired of having to deal with these aspects of our mental health. And then what's interesting is that you would think coming into May with good news about reopenings of businesses and the state and opportunities for people to get vaccinated, that we would be feeling this euphoria, this joy of being set free in some ways. But the interesting thing is that the opposite seems to be happening, that we have gotten so kind of numb to the year, or maybe we've gone inwards, or we've tried to be so self-protecting to just kind of survive, that now that a few things are starting to open up, we're actually seeing people triggered in different ways, that those anxiety feelings or the stress or the trauma or the disappointment had been suppressed in such a way that now that we're able to actually move around and express ourselves, those other feelings are already also starting to present. So I just wanted to make you aware that if you are feeling extra anxious, even though we get to go meet up with friends, but there's still the concern of, is it safe? Should we mask? Should we not mask? That would be a normal response. If you're starting to really feel anger and frustration and wonder why now that we get to not worry so much, that also would be a normal response because we've repressed those feelings for so long. So the theme of this year's Mental Health Awareness Month is actually tools to thrive. And it's a reminder that there are a lot of practical things that we can do to maintain our mental health and well-being that don't require us actually going to a professional or going to someone's office, that we have those tools readily available, aside from, you know, going for a walk or eating good food or catching your breath, that we have those daily tools of noticing those small details that make us smile, or taking a moment to try something different or try a different food. You know, anything we can do that sparks newness in our psyche helps to bring up our mood, helps to lift our attitude or lift our spirits. And so there are tiny things that we can do. It don't have to be grand gestures. It doesn't mean packing up everyone and going in the RV. It can be as simple as walking to work a different way or going for a walk in a different direction, or again, trying a different food. And if you'd like to have some specific tools, there are tools that are available through Mental Health America. Their website is mhnational.org. So it's Mental Health America. So I think it's mhanational.org, excuse me, mhanational.org. And they will be happy to send you a toolkit. Just go onto their website and ask for it. And they have all sorts of practical tools for dealing with adapting to trauma and stress, dealing with anger and frustration, getting out of thinking traps where we get kind of caught in this rumination about worst case scenarios, how to process big changes, because I think we're all kind of stepping lightly out into the future and not really sure what the world's going to look like moving forward. And so that takes energy and time to process these big changes that are coming towards us. Another toolkit for how to take time for ourselves, and then a toolkit for radical acceptance. And I think that's one of the keys, is that we have to be able to adapt to whatever this new normal is, or we're going to get bogged down. We can't afford to mourn and grieve too much about the things we've lost, because we've been there for the last year plus. We have to be able to find little steps forward, radical acceptance of what is, so that we can actually start to open up and feel joy again, or to experience pleasure, or to find ourselves in some place where we feel awe. Because that's what really balances our mental health. When we can tap into something and feel small and feel just completely immersed in a moment that feels overwhelming, those are the things that get our heart beating again and make us feel like life is worth living. So just a few reminders as we move through this month to take some time for a check-in, see how you're doing, and to reach out for help if you think that's going to be something that will help you make your way through the month. And so my guest this week is a perfect role model for Mental Health Awareness Month. I don't know if he wants to be the poster person for Mental Health Awareness Month, but I'm kind of pushing him into that spot. Dr. Ryan Alaniz is our guest this week, and he is an associate professor of sociology at Cal Poly. And that's just his professional moniker, but he's actually many different things in this world. And one of the reasons I was excited to have Dr. Alaniz on the show is because of all of the other interests that he has in his life that help to balance his mental health and well-being, that he has a lot of outlets to lift himself, or to pique his curiosity, or to put him in a state of awe. So I first met Dr. Alaniz through our intern this year, Sasha. Sasha had Dr. Alaniz as a professor and was really excited about his class and his lectures and his subject matter, and particularly around a program that he's been developing to earn a BA in sociology at the California Men's Colony prison for the people that were incarcerated there. And she said, "This is a really important program. You need to talk to Dr. Alaniz." I said, "Great. Let's have him on." And then I started looking a little more into Dr. Alaniz's life. And he's not only developing this entire curriculum and program for inmates to earn their BA in sociology, but he's also written books. He's a researcher. He's a community builder. He's a father. He's a surfer, a kayak guide, a soccer player, a farmer, beekeeper, teacher, and continual learner with specialties in a wide variety of areas, including disasters, community development, water scarcity and drought, and correctional education. So we have a lot of directions to go today, but I'm looking forward to hearing more of the story of Dr. Alaniz, and also to talk about all the positive things that we can do in the midst of a really tough life or a tough world that still make getting up every day worthwhile. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of the conversation by giving us a call at 805-549-8855, and Francisco will be happy to read your question over the air if there's some commoner question that you might have. You can always follow us on Facebook or on Instagram, and right now we're actually doing our Instagram Live. So if you go to The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram, you can tune in. I see some people there. Hello, thanks for joining us. You can send us an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, and you can always podcast our show to listen at your convenience by visiting wherever you get your podcasts. Look for our show, hit subscribe, leave a review to share with other people so that we can keep the conversations going. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to start our conversation with Dr. Ryan Alaniz. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Dr. Ryan Alanis, thank you for joining me today on the show.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
All right, so I want to jump right into your primary role, your professional role as associate professor of sociology at Cal Poly. Because I think if you were to ask a group of people about different majors, many might point to sociology as being considered kind of a light major in the field of all, you know, the science and technologies out there. And so I'm curious to know how you found your way to being interested in sociology and also becoming a professor. Why this discipline?
That's a great question. And I'll have to give a little bit of a historical context. So I grew up born and raised in Napomo, California. I went to Rio Grande High School. My dad was a farm supervisor, and I had that experience of working in the fields. Neither of my parents got a college degree. And so the furthest imagination that I had was maybe someday I could be I've always loved teaching. I thought maybe I could be a professor at Hancock or Cuesta. But over time, I was able to spend some time abroad volunteering. And I came back from that time in Central America just really deeply engaged in these social justice questions about why does poverty exist? Why are there so many people suffering in the world when we here on the Central Coast live in real luxury? And trying to make sense of these vast inequalities that dominate our world. And so I returned to school after graduating from Cal Poly and volunteering. I returned to school for a master's degree at UCSB. And I was talking to a professor there, and I said, you know, I could go back. I was looking at two different directions. I was interested in maybe returning to Central America and working at an orphanage again or starting an orphanage, because I loved working with children and supporting those who are most marginalized in our society, or perhaps maybe going to get a PhD. And he said, Ryan, you know, you can help hundreds, maybe thousands of kids if you return to Honduras. But if you have the opportunity that so few people in the world have to obtain a PhD, then you can start to not only affect policy on national or international levels, which will affect millions of people, but you'll also be able to teach and be able to shape the way that the next generation sees the world. And to me, it was just a really easy answer then. I had to keep learning. And so I went on for my PhD, and I did that in sociology because I found that sociology was the most deeply engaged in trying to affect change, to make the world a better place. You had mentioned it being like a soft subject in universities, and I think that is a stereotype. But we're also the ones who are really wrestling with the greatest issues of race and class and gender and sexual orientation, of homelessness, of all of the social ills that are dominating our society right now, gun violence. It's sociologists who are really wrestling with this, the social scientists who want to... We're not going to send a car to the moon we're not going to be bringing people to Mars based on our skill, but we may be able to save the planet and save our society. And so I think that I have a lot of respect for my engineering faculty colleagues, but I also want to make sure that there's a recognition that the social sciences and the humanities have a role to ensure that our lives every day are worth living.
I agree. And, you know, because I also work in the College of Liberal Arts, and so I'm very passionate about teaching people in general how to think, which I think the liberal arts do. Instead of teaching one method of solving a problem, it kind of opens you up to being able to think broadly. But why do you think sociology, because I don't know if you asked someone, what does someone with a sociology degree do, if they would ever align it with social justice issues? Like, why is it that people don't understand what sociology is or what sociologists do? And what does someone with a degree you know, aside from getting a PhD, end up using it for?
Yeah, I think there's just been a lack of, I don't think sociologists have done a good enough job of explaining the value of what we do. So it's pretty easy. You may have heard that old saying, you know, if you want to feed a person for a day, you give them a fish. And if you want to feed them for a lifetime, you teach them how to fish. And what I add to that is, if you want to, we need to also ask the question, why didn't the person have a fish in the first place? And so really trying to address these root causes of why there's so much injustice in the world. It's easy to look at a major disaster like what's happening in the Rohingya communities in Bangladesh, where they've been pushed out of Burma, or to look at Syria, or to look at the migration of children from Honduras and be like, oh my gosh, this is so horrible. We need to stop it. It's often all about putting a Band-Aid on it. It's often about just the relief of that immediate suffering. Whereas as a sociologist, I want to step back and look at the broader context and say, well, why does that even exist in the first place? I have a colleague at Ohio State University. We were friends in graduate school. And what she studies is genocide. And she's been looking at different genocides over time. And what she found is that there's kind of mechanisms or steps that lead up to a genocide. And her idea is that if we can understand these steps well enough, then the UN or another international organization can intercede to prevent a genocide from actually happening. And so sociologists, we're not quite as pragmatic or practical as, say, a psychologist who is working with people individually. It just makes sense, right? You just help people with their mental or physical therapist. Rather, we're trying to heal society on a macro level. And so sociology students are able to obtain research skills and this critical thinking about race and class and gender, and then apply it to whatever they go into. So the joke is that, you know, with a sociology degree, you can do anything, but you can do anything. And so it can be overwhelming about what you can do with it. But our concentrations at Cal Poly are to send students into the criminal justice field. So becoming lawyers or maybe police officers, working for the FBI, to work in social services. So become social workers or work with families, work in the government, organizations, which is human resources. So anybody that wants to work in business and to work with people in business. And finally to what's called an independent course of study. So a lot of our students get minors. So a minor in psychology, for example, if they want to combine their sociology degree with a psychology degree.
Well, and you would think that that would be a really important combination, to have a psych degree and a sociology minor, or even the other way around if you want to be a clinician. Because I often think that people go into psychology thinking it's about becoming a clinician, and it's really not the curriculum for clinicians. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but I would think a sociology degree is much more aligned curriculum for actually doing work with human beings, and psychology would be a nice minor to that, to understand some of the workings of the brain or, you know, neuroscience. So I wish there was much more interaction and understanding the application of sociology.
Yeah, and I had a great conversation with a couple of colleagues who were doctors when we were taking in Honduras, and I had been discussing with them about how fortunate they must feel that they can work with people on an everyday level, healing people, like making people feel better. And they said, no, actually, Ryan, we really look up to you as a sociologist because you can look at why the people got sick in the first place. What were these other big, these broader issues that had led to their illness? And then you can address issues of policy or maybe within the community to look at water or sanitation or how food is being distributed. So I think there's really a place for all of these. And the recognition, as you mentioned, that they're all valuable because they all intersect and help us understand why these problems exist.
I agree. And, you know, I was thinking, because last week I had Dr. Rhian Eisler on, we were talking about her domination and partnership studies. And I would think that that'd be very sociological and anthropological in its way of looking at culture. That it, she was saying, if we're going to change anything, it can't just be let's become a matriarchy or let's just make sure we're Democrats. It's not about being a Democrat or Republican or matriarch, that it really is about what is the foundational story of our culture and how we operate. And so I would think that that sociology would be such a great essential skill for people to understand so that they wouldn't be so afraid of terms like defund the police or decolonize psychology, because it all sounds like chaos. But there's much more of a fundamental reason for that, right? For that understanding.
Absolutely. I think when people start to break it down, most people will probably be in agreement that there are that we have similar values around life, around people having independence to make their own decisions, or what we call agency, that people want greater equity in society. These are just common human values. But what happens is a lot of these narratives get all mixed up, and these justifications and paradigms. And especially now, I think with the with a lot of the different conspiracy theories, a lot of the beliefs where people can throw any belief out without evidence on the internet and find people to listen, it becomes a little bit more challenging because there's a lot more narratives flying around, many without evidence. So I think backing it up and saying, okay, everyone, these degrees, these classes are important because they help you differentiate what is true based on facts and evidence versus what somebody is just saying based on their own personal experience.
Or to try to protect their vantage point in society, because those who are in power benefit from throwing out a lot of smokescreen narratives and fear so that people won't allow change to happen. And I just want to go back a little bit, because you talked about the focus of sociology and one of them being on criminal justice and another, like becoming a police officer, which I find interesting. Because a lot of the conversations about defunding police and policing and, you know, dismantling prison systems, how do you look at that right now?
I think there's a lot of idealism, and there's a lot of and then there's the people that are a little bit more pragmatic. So there is this idea of maybe we can just have a revolution and all of a sudden we reinvent the system to address all of the problems embedded. And I've seen that. I've been working in the county jail for 6 years, teaching classes in the county jail for 6 years. I taught for 2.5 years at California Men's Colony. So I know there's problems in these systems. And anybody working there would tell you there's problems in these systems, but that's not how life works. And that's not how institutions or bureaucracies work. They take time and they take negotiation because, as you mentioned, there are people who want it to stay the same. And so the terminology of defund the police, I think, is very problematic because it just sounds like, well, we're going to take all the money away from the police and we're going to put it somewhere else. And that's actually not what people are saying, but that's what it sounds like. And so often we have this knee-jerk political reaction to these ideas. So there, I think we just need to kind of tone down the rhetoric, tone down tone down these kind of big claims and say, well, let's sit down together. Do we agree that since we're only 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners, can we agree that that's a problem? Okay, if we can agree on that, well, what's the next step? Let's start to break this down a little bit. Why is it that we have so many African American and Latino men incarcerated compared to other groups, if they commit the same or use drugs about the same amount? What is it about these systems that are broken, and can we come to some easier compromise? Now, that's not revolutionary, and it's not what people won't see change, even potentially in their lifetime. But I think, as we were talking a little bit before, if we really want to get to the heart and soul, the root issues, we have to get everybody on board with changing the system. We can't just throw up a new system with people against it, because that won't work either.
Right, because then we're going back to just the binary. It's either Democrat or Republican, or good or bad people, that we're just then flip-flopping from one actual power dynamic. You know, because if we defund, we're still in a power dynamic of someone else being in charge of how people are treated or how they're, because, and I'm going off topic a little bit, because I keep thinking, you know, when they say defund the police, we'll throw a lot of money at social workers or at mental health care workers. It's still a power hierarchy, that mental health workers are still going to institutionalize people who are mentally ill, just in a different kind of institutionalized situation. Or you still, you know, have the power as a mental health professional to diagnose or treat someone or label them. And so I think that that's a little too easy of a fix to think that we'll throw a bunch of mental health care at the issues and then that solves it. That you're, what you're saying is we have to, hopefully, if we get to the root cause, we diminish the amount of policing or institutional prison sentences that we have. Would that be more aligned with it?
Absolutely. And with policing, police show up after the fact, which means that the crime was already committed, which means that the people who commit the crime were already in a bad situation in the first place. Let me just tell you a quick story of one of the women that I worked with, who was in my class. So I teach a class at the county jail called Incarceration in Society, and I bring in 8 Cal Poly students, and we meet with 8 incarcerated women and have the class inside the county jail. And so I had the students do some reading about the issue, the idea of oppression. And I had asked them to kind of explore it as oppression as it relates to their own life. And so this woman, I'll call her Lynn, it's a pseudonym, she was telling us a little bit about her story. She was incarcerated. And so she said that she grew up in Lompoc, got pregnant in high school, and married the man that she got pregnant with, another high school student, didn't graduate. And by the early 20s had 3 or 4 kids. Maybe she had 3 kids. I don't quite remember. But she was completely financially dependent on her husband. Her family was poor and they couldn't take her and her 3 kids back. So she was completely dependent on her husband. Her husband, unfortunately, wasn't very kind to her, was both emotionally and later physically abusive. So here she is, no college, no high school education, 3 kids in poverty, no ability to support herself. So she turned to a way to try and cope with this situation. She turned to cocaine, because at least then she felt a little bit of relief in this challenging, chaotic life. So one day she was pulled over by the police. They found that she had her kids and that she had cocaine in the car. And so she was arrested. She'll lose her kids and she'll be going to prison. Now, I don't think anybody should have cocaine or be on cocaine and driving around. I think there should be consequences to that. But I can step into her shoes and understand why she made that decision. And for me, it goes back to that James Bradford quote, "But for the grace of God, go I." Had I been Lynn, had I gotten pregnant as a teenager, had I been dependent on this abusive man, I would probably want some kind of escape too. And so I think if we can hold people who are incarcerated, people who are arrested, with more compassion and empathy, knowing that they probably are just doing the best that they can with the situation that they have, that then we can start to think a little bit differently about the criminal justice system, the institutions, and maybe how can we help people before they are committing crimes.
Almost pre-care instead of post-care. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Dr. Ryan Alanis. He is an associate professor of sociology at Cal Poly. He is also currently developing a opportunity at the Men's Colony Prison for those incarcerated to earn a BA in psychology. in psychology, in sociology. He's developing this program to earn a BA in sociology. And we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back. We're going to focus on this program that Dr. Alanis is putting together and why this program is important to offer to those that are incarcerated and what kind of differences or changes that may make in their life or maybe in society moving forward. And we're also going to talk about those other ways that Dr. Alanis not only contributes to the betterment of society, but also cares for himself as a father and a surfer and a kayak guide and a soccer player and a farmer and a beekeeper. So we have a lot to talk about. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back. We can also take your calls at 805-549-8855. And also join us on Instagram Live if you want to. Just find us at The Reluctant Therapist and tune in, and you can see Dr. Alanis in person. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Love is but a song we sing. Fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing and you may not know why. Come on, people now, smile.
If you made a contribution during our spring pledge drive, thank you so much. It's people like you who make it possible for KCBX to broadcast programs like this one. While we did finish shy of our goal, it's not too late to make your gift. If you haven't yet become a member or renewed your support, you can still do so at kcbx.org, where you can check our progress or call during business hours at 800-549-8855. Our conversation with the Reluctant Therapist continues. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you, Francisco. And yes, I am excited to have our guest here today, Dr. Ryan Alanis. And let's jump into this program. What inspired you to start teaching at the prison and at the county jail and to go as far as trying to put together this BA degree in sociology?
The inspiration to developing this class first at the county jail really came from the Cal Poly itself, its motto, learn by doing. Because I was recognizing that students in sociology were graduating with a concentration in criminal justice without ever having met somebody who had been incarcerated or having visited the county jail. And that didn't make sense to me. So I wanted to develop a class at least where they were able to tour the jail and meet people inside and hear the different perspectives. I think that it's easier to hear people's perspectives from the outside, police officers, the district attorney, the sheriff's department, et cetera. But it's much harder to hear people's voices when they're behind 6 feet of concrete and razor wire. And so getting us into that, and I want to give a shout out both to the sheriff's department and to the California Men's Colony, because in both cases, they have been very welcoming and accommodating with starting the class. And then across the college as well, which has been putting hundreds of men at California Men's Colony through their AA program. And it's been one of the biggest programs in the state. It's been an excellent, excellent program. And so in conversation with the CMC staff, we recognize that many of these men will be graduating with the associate's degree of transfer in sociology, but then that was it. They were done and they had no more opportunity to continue their education. And so after doing more research and recognizing that CSU Los Angeles had a program that offered a BA program, and now Pitzer and University of California, Irvine had a program, it made sense given that Cal Poly shares a fence line with CMC that we should also provide a program, especially since there's so many men that were ready to take it. You know, they had all of their general education requirements finished. So in conversation with the CMC educational staff and with Cuesta, I started to develop a BA program. And we've gotten permission from Cal Poly, and we've gotten permission from the Chancellor's Office of the California State University Chancellor's Office. And we have the California Department of Correction and Rehabilitation. They are very interested in supporting this program. So we're pretty much ready to go. Faculty are ready to go. The education staff at CMC are ready to go. We just haven't found funding. And so with the turmoil of the state budget and nobody knowing where that money is going to be in a year or two, right now we are currently looking for funds to help these men obtain their bachelor's degree. And there's a couple of justifications. You know, there's a heavy critique, like, well, why should we give these bachelor's degrees to people that are incarcerated? Why can't we just give them to other folks, to correctional officers or to the public or to more Cal Poly students? And that's a fair critique. But the justification is threefold. First, it saves us money. So for the state to incarcerate somebody for 1 year, it costs us taxpayers $81,000. So it costs us more to keep them in CMC than it does to send three students to Cal Poly for a year. And so if we can get them out earlier and they get release time for the classes that they take, we're going to be saving the state money. Additionally, there's a term called recidivism, or to recidivate, which it means for people that have been incarcerated, who get out and then commit a crime and are incarcerated again, they recidivate, they go back. And so 86%, according to the FBI, 83%, according to the FBI, of felons, of people that have committed a felony, will return to prison after they leave within 9 years. And so this is a complete, in my opinion, failure of our criminal justice system, where 4 out of 5 of the people that leave come back. So we're not doing that rehabilitation very well, or at least not well enough to keep people out of prison. So, however, if we were able to give them a bachelor's degree, according to some research done in prisons in Texas, if they get a bachelor's degree while they're incarcerated, they leave with an education, they can get jobs, they can start becoming taxpayers, and that recidivism rate drops from 83% to 6%. So there's this massive shift in people's lives once they're educated, not only because they're thinking differently about the world, but because they have this diploma that can help them get viable jobs. Unfortunately, people that do have felonies, there are thousands and thousands of rules that actually prevent them from getting decent jobs. They might not be able to join a union, for example. They can't become a barber because they have rules about who can receive this, these types of certifications. They can't receive any federal grant money to attend schools. So there's all of these challenges, which essentially put people right back into the same situation that sent them to prison in the first place. So that's why rehabilitation is so critically important, is it because it will make our society safer, it will save us money, and it will really help these communities of color, where 1 out of every 3 Black men will be incarcerated in their lives, sucking them out of the community. It will help those men stay in their community or go back into their community and be positive role models in their community as well.
And I would imagine that in the process of earning a degree in sociology, it would do some self-healing around trauma and loss because of the subject matter they're studying as well, understanding the source of their original trauma or situations in their own lives.
That's right, Elizabeth. A lot of the men and women that I've worked with, they really hate themselves. They grew up with what we call internalized depression. Their lives, when you hear them share about their lives, you'll be humbled. I'm always humbled by the trauma, by the abuse, by the neglect that they've received. And it makes perfect sense that, like, oh, of course you're going to be incarcerated. You didn't have a chance even to grow up. One of my best students, he saw his father murdered in his living room at 9 years old, and his mother was a crack addict. And so at 9 years old, he didn't have a chance to be successful in this world. And now he's doing great work. He's taking rehabilitation seriously. He's going to be at the top of his class. And now I'm not going to say that everybody in California Men's Colony is like that. You know, there aren't, it's not a group of angels by any means. But I think that idea of that we can all change and become better, that there are people in there that deeply, deeply want to be released and do well for their families. That's the people that I really want to give a chance to be able to get a BA program and start their lives over again.
You're listening to my guest, Dr. Ryan Alanese. He's the Associate Professor of Sociology at Cal Poly. Born and raised in Napomo, went to Rio Grande High School, worked in the fields with his parents, and found his way to Cal Poly and then a PhD at UCSB, and has taken this passion for people and is in developing this program at the Men's Colony. And so when you talk about needing funding, is that private funding, or is that, are you trying to get the CSU to find money? Can the Men's Colony come up with money? How does that happen?
Yes to all of the above. We're trying to find money anywhere that we can. We're figuring that's going to cost about $25,000 to get one guy through the 2.5 year program, because they can only take two classes at a time, to get their bachelor's degree if they start with an AA degree. So that's our plan, is we're hoping to have a cohort between 20 to 30 guys who have their AA degree to start in fall of 2023. And within 2.5 years, we'll have our first graduating class. And so each year we'll look at about $200,000 to $300,000, depending on how many students we have. And currently we are looking for private funding. We will be, we are looking for grants as well. We're working with the CSU, and we're working with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. There isn't a lot of public government funding for this right now. And so we will be, at least for the first cohort, we will probably be looking for private donations to get this started.
So Dr. Alanese, I want to shift gears a little bit, because that's a huge undertaking, you know, a full heart undertaking to not only teach your full load at Cal Poly and inspire your students, but then to transfer that into the prison system to uplift the lives of people who in many ways would have a hopeless future. And this is Mental Health Awareness Month that I talked about at the beginning of the show. And so there's a whole nother side of you that has a lot of passions that I want to tap into a little bit, because I think it's so important for people to hear that we can do one amazing thing, like taking care of this program, but still have this full life that supports our mental health, because I'd imagine it's taxing and can be overwhelming and can be draining to do this work. And so you've built a life that also includes being a father and a surfer and a kayak guide and a soccer player and a farmer and a beekeeper. And I read on your website, and I might have gotten this wrong, so you can fill in the gaps, that you garden and save seeds and plant trees and care for the earth. You have 3 goats, 40 chickens, a dog, 4 cats, and 20 beehives. And you made a list of things to build something new every year between 2013 and 2021. I don't know how you have time for all that, but tell me about these passions a little bit and what got you started. We can start with beekeeping and farming if you'd like.
Well, farming is, I grew up on a farm, and I have a deep respect for the land. And I feel that us in the United States, we're pretty alienated from our own food. We don't know, even today, if many of my students are asking, I show 6 pictures of different vegetables before they actually, as saplings, as kind of little transplants. And I ask them what they are, and most students have no idea what these things are, and until it arrives packaged and beautiful with a label on the supermarket shelves. So I didn't want to be that way. I wanted to know where my food came from. I wanted to see what it looked like. I wanted to grow it from the ground up and understand it. And previously, my hope was to become a grocery store free family, so that we were either grow everything that we needed more or less, or trade it, or go to the farmer's market and get it. That's very, very challenging if you have a full-time job and kids. But nevertheless, I think it was an ideal to follow. We didn't quite get there, but we were able to do quite a bit. And so farming, yeah, has always been a really beautiful passion, and beekeeping too. I actually just tagged along to the Cal Poly beekeeping class. Luckily, I got in because I was a faculty member and they just let me sit in the back. But I found that it's a really beautiful and necessary and important hobby for folks these days, given the impact on bees and the decreasing bee population. And bees have a lot to teach us. One quick story I like to tell about bees is that if the colony collapses and they're left alone, because they live very communally, they depend on each other, they could go to any other hive and walk right in and be accepted. They don't look at color, they don't look at size, they don't look at anything. They just said, yeah, come on in, join us. So I think we have a lot to learn from bees.
And how does this impact your mental health, having these passions?
I think, you know, a lot of my work is a super downer. Studying sociology, studying all the inequalities in the world, sometimes it's hard to watch a movie because you start to see gender inequality and imbalance and power and violence in a deep way, because you know that this is representative of so much of what's going on. So I have to turn off my sociological brain, and putting my hands in the dirt enables me to do that, or my hands in the hive, or being in the ocean allows me, as you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, being in deeply embedded in something so much grander and bigger than you is a humbling experience and a reminder that it's not all about me. I'm a speck, and I have to have a deep respect for this ocean, or for the environment, the mountains.
And do you ever think about bringing the farming, beekeeping to the prison system as well?
I have, in fact, my two students and I worked together to receive a grant. This was back in 2014, I think. We received a grant to build a garden on the honor farm in the men's jail at the county jail, the men's side of the jail. And so we got a grant, and then we built that, and then Restorative Partners and her name is Jill in particular, took it over. And so they've been running this garden since 2014 and providing organic, yummy, local food to the people that are incarcerated on a daily basis. So that was a really neat experience to work with these two students who did most of the work. And that again, the county jail and the sheriff, I have to give them a lot of props because they were open to that idea.
Yeah, and it does seem that there's a lot of people that have to get on board with any sort of changes, because again, it can threaten their narrative of why they are, because I would think that'd be tough too, if you're working in the prison system and you have any consciousness, you've got to be questioning the narrative as to why you are working in a prison or holding people captive. I mean, I think this is a really challenging time for everyone, because everyone is rethinking the whole foundation of their work and why they do that work, or what is its purpose in the greater scheme of things. Now, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Dr. Ryan Alanis, Associate Professor of Sociology at Cal Poly. And we're tapping into some of those ways that you balance the challenges of being so sociologically aware and trying to be a dad and a surfer and a kayaker. So what do you see for your children? How do you envision a future for them? What are you preparing them for?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think I have a son who's 12. I want him to be deeply empathetic to everybody, rich, poor, different ethnicities and races, different genders. And just to be able to really put himself in their shoes and walk around for a moment and try and understand why they are the way they are, perhaps try and understand why they act the way that they do, and just have a large respect. I also want him to be aware of the ecological consequence of his behavior, as we consume. We're such a consumerist society. We're devastating our planet, and it's unsustainable. Susan George, when we were talking a few years ago, shared with me, based on her research, that if we wanted to give everybody a middle-class lifestyle that we live in the United States, if we wanted to give everybody more or less that middle-class lifestyle, which is a lot less than what we live in San Luis Obispo, many of us, that we'd need 6.5 Earths worth of resources to be able to provide that. So our lifestyle is just unsustainable. So I'd like him to be very aware that of his ecological footprint, and to live very simply, as the saying goes, so others may simply live.
Do you have a hard time being upbeat for him? I mean, what is the light for him moving forward? Because I'm just, you know, from a parental perspective, a part of our job is to help open up a future for our children that we are excited for them to live. And you mentioned some challenging pieces, which I think is kind of defining Generation Z. But as a professor working with young people and your own son, what is the light moving forward for you? What do you teach?
At the very last class that I give, every single last class, I talk about how to affect social change. And the human race and individuals are so beautifully resilient that we can change our minds, we can change our societies dramatically if we so choose. I'll give just a brief example of this kind of resilience. When I was, again, working at the orphanage at Christmas time, the kids had nothing to their name. They had a small locker that was everything that they owned, which is a couple pairs of clothes. They didn't even have their own toys. And in order for them to receive a Christmas gift, each one of the kids, and I work with the little ones, the 2 to 7 year olds, they each took a toy from their communal pile. And we walked with them to the neighboring community, where they handed over one of their toys to another child who was even poorer than they were. And so in my own mind, if these small children who had nothing to their name in the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere can do something as generous as that, look what we can do as being part of the wealthiest 5, 10, 1% of the world's population if we so chose. And so I would hope that both my students and my son and everybody that I speak to recognizes that they have this great agency. I tell my students at the beginning of class every day, I say, good morning, future leaders of the world. And I say that because they go to the best university in the richest city in one of the richest counties in the richest state in the richest nation in the world, the most powerful nation in history. So whether they like it or not, every one of their decisions, every one of their consumer choices, every one of their actions is going to have consequences around the world. And so we are leaders just by default. So utilizing that agency for good is so exciting. And when I see students actually like grab hold and recognize that they can do great things, it's just beautiful. They're like shooting stars. And I often tell them, like, I can't wait to read about you in the New York Times someday. I can't wait to see or hear your Nobel Peace Prize speech someday.
And I feel that as well in my class. I tell them, you have the privilege of coming to this university and living this life, but that comes with the responsibilities that this isn't just a gift that you get to take for your own benefit, that you now have earned the responsibility to take what you've learned out into the world and make it a better place for the collective good, that a college degree is not just for your own well-being, it's for the collective good. The entire nation is invested in you doing something with this degree. So maybe, you know, that's the light that I see as well, because our students are more adept in ways in the last 10 years than I would have imagined, the way they're aware of things that are going on. So in our last couple minutes, I just want to tap on the things that you built between 2013 and 2021. For some reason, that stuck in my mind because I keep thinking about the heaviness of the work that you do and the responsibility of teaching the next generation. And so your caregiving, what are two or three of your favorite things you built between 2013 and 2021?
I built a yurt. That was pretty fun with my good friend Ginny. And I built an orchard, or I planted an orchard of about 35 trees, which was really, really cool too. I got to learn grafting and how to take care of trees. And that's a beautiful thing too, is that, you know, even if we have a small yard, we can often grow a lot of our own vegetables, you know, even a lawn. Maybe we don't need a lawn. Maybe instead we turn that into a vegetable garden. And so there, learning about these things also becomes very empowering, because then you feel like, oh, I don't need to call a handyman, or I don't need to call a gardener. Like, I'm going to do this myself. And it puts us back in the present moment, where we're working with the earth and seeing the beauty of that reciprocal relationship. If I take care of this tree now, it's going to provide fruit next spring or next summer. And so I think for me, those are kind of my favorites. One, to see something be built and to stand up and not fall over. And two, to see these beautiful flowers right now on these trees blossoming. And then, of course, my bees all over them.
And your face lights up. I wish people could see the joy in your face as you talk about the projects you're doing to better the world and your life, and also your project at the Men's Colony Prison. Dr. Ryan Alanis, thank you so much for giving me an hour of your time. If people want to find out more about the BA program in sociology at the California Men's Colony, how can they contact you or find out about funding or be a part of the program?
Yeah, they're welcome to contact me via my email address, my Cal Poly email address, which is my first initial R, Ryan, and my last name, Alanis, R-A-L-A-N-I-Z, at calpoly.edu.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to this show and other shows at kcbx.org. You can podcast our show. You can watch our Instagram Live, which we'll be posting after the show if you missed any of it. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and I can help to connect you to Dr. Alanis. And you can follow us on Facebook. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for being part of the conversation. And we'll return next week to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.